Chapter 15. On that Friday, when Christmas was captured in Mottstown, there lived in the town an old couple named Hines. They were quite old. They lived in a small bungalow in a neighborhood of Negroes. How, upon what, the town in general didn't know, since they appeared to live in filthy poverty and complete idleness. Hines, as far as the town knew, not having done any work, steady work, in 25 years. They came to Mottstown 30 years ago. One day the town found the woman established in the small house where they had lived ever since, though for the next 5 years Hines was at home only once a month over the weekend. Soon it became known that he held some kind of a position in Memphis. Exactly what wasn't known, since even at that time he was a secret man who could have been either 35 or 50, with something in his glance coldly and violently fanatical and a little crazed, precluding questioning, curiosity. The town looked upon them both as being a little touched, lonely, gray in color, a little smaller than most other men and women, as if they belonged to a different race, species, even though for the next 5 or 6 years after, the man appeared to have come to Mottstown to settle down for good in the small house where his wife lived. People hired him to do various odd jobs which they considered within his strength. But in time, he stopped this too. The town wondered for a while how they would live now. Then it forgot to speculate about this, just as later, when the town learned that Hines went on foot about the county, holding revival services in Negro churches, and that now and then Negro women, carrying what were obviously dishes of food, would be seen entering from the rear the house where the couple lived, and emerging empty-handed, it wondered about this for a time, and then forgot it. In time, the town either forgot or condoned, because Hines was an old man and harmless, that which in a young man it would have crucified. It just said, "They're crazy. Crazy on the subject of Negroes. Maybe they're Yankees." And let it go at that. Or perhaps what it condoned wasn't the man's self-dedication to the saving of Negro souls, but the public ignoring of the fact of that charity which they received from Negro hands, since it's a happy faculty of the mind to slough that which conscience refuses to assimilate. So for 25 years the old couple had had no visible means of support, the town blinding its collective eye to the Negro women and the covered dishes and pans, particularly as some of the dishes and pans had in all likelihood been born intact from white kitchens where the women cooked. Perhaps this was a part of the mind sloughing. Anyway, the town didn't look, and for 25 years now the couple had lived in the slack backwater of their lonely isolation, like they might have been two musk oxen strayed from the North Pole, or two homeless and belated beasts from beyond the glacial period. The woman was hardly ever seen at all, though the man, he was known as Uncle Doc, was a fixture about the square, a dirty little old man with a face which had once been either courageous or violent, either a visionary or a supreme egoist, collarless, in dirty blue jean clothes, and with a heavy piece of hand-peeled hickory worn about the grip, dark as walnut and smooth as glass. At first, while he held the Memphis position, on his monthly visits he'd talked a little about himself, with a self-confidence not alone of the independent man, but with a further quality, as though at one time in his life he'd been better than independent, and that not long ago. And there was nothing beaten about him. It was rather that confidence of a man who's had the controlling of lesser men, and who had voluntarily, and for a reason which he believed that no other man could question or comprehend, changed his life. But what he told about himself and his present occupation didn't make sense, for all its apparent coherence. So they believed that he was a little crazy, even then. It wasn't that he seemed to be trying to conceal one thing by telling another. It was that his words, his telling, just didn't synchronize with what his hearers believed would and must be the scope of a single individual. Sometimes they decided that he'd once been a minister. Then he would talk about Memphis, the city, in a vague and splendid way, as though all his life he'd been incumbent there of some important, though still nameless, municipal office. "Sure," the man in Mottstown said behind his back. "He was railroad superintendent there, standing in the middle of the street, crossing with a red flag every time a train passed. Or, he's a big newspaper man, gathers up the papers from under the park benches." They didn't say this to his face, not the boldest among them, not the ones with the most precariously nourished reputations for wit. Then he lost the Memphis job or quit it. One weekend he came home, and when Monday came he didn't go away. After that he was downtown all day long about the square, untalkative, dirty, with that furious and preclusive expression about the eyes which the people took for insanity, that quality of outworn violence like a scent, an odor, that fanaticism like a fading and almost extinct ember of some kind of two-fisted evangelism which had been one quarter violent conviction and three quarters physical hardihood. So they weren't so surprised when they learned that he was going about the county, usually on foot, preaching in Negro churches. Not even when a year later they learned what his subject was. That this white man, who very nearly depended on the bounty and charity of Negroes for sustenance, was going single-handed into remote Negro churches and interrupting the service to enter the pulpit and in his harsh, dead voice, and at times with violent obscenity, preach to them humility before all skins lighter than theirs, preaching the superiority of the white race, himself his own Exhibit A, and fanatic and unconscious paradox. The Negroes believed that he was crazy, touched by God, or having once touched him. They probably didn't listen to, couldn't understand much of what he said. Perhaps they took him to be God himself, since God to them was a white man too, and his doings also a little inexplicable. He was downtown that afternoon when Christmas's name first flew up and down the street, and the boys and men, the merchants, the clerks, the idle, and the curious, with countrymen in overalls predominating, began to run. Hines ran too, but he couldn't run fast, and he wasn't tall enough to see over the clotted shoulders when he did arrive. Nevertheless, he tried, as brutal and intent as any there, to force his way into the loud surging group as though in a resurgence of the old violence which had marked his face, clawing at the backs and at last striking at them with a stick until men turned and recognized him and held him struggling, striking at them with the heavy stick. "Christmas!" he shouted. "Did they say Christmas?" "Christmas!" one of the men who held him cried back, his face, too, straining, glaring. "Christmas! That white nigger that did that killing up at Jefferson last week." Hines glared at the man, his toothless mouth lightly foamed with spittle. Then he struggled again, violent, cursing, a frail little old man with the light, frail bones of a child, trying to fight free with a stick, trying to club his way into the center where the captive stood bleeding about the face. "Now, Uncle Doc," they said, holding him, "now, Uncle Doc, they got him. He can't get away here now." But he struggled and fought, cursing. His voice cracked, thin, his mouth slavering. They who held him struggling, too, like men trying to hold a small threshing hose in which the pressure is too great for its size. Of the entire group, the captive was the only calm one. They held Hines, cursing, his old frail bones and his string-like muscles for the time inherent with the fluid and supple fury of a weasel. He broke free of them and sprang forward, burrowing, and broke through and came face to face with the captive. Here he paused for an instant, glaring at the captive's face. It was a full pause, but before they could grasp him again, he'd raised the stick and struck the captive once, and he was trying to strike again when they caught him at last and held him impotent and raging with that light, thin foam about his lips. They hadn't stopped his mouth.
"Kill a bastard," he cried. "Kill him! Kill him!"
30 minutes later, two men brought him home in a car. One of them drove while the other held Hines up in the back seat. His face was pale now beneath the stubble and the dirt, and his eyes were closed. They lifted him bodily from the car and carried him through the gate and up the walk of rotting bricks and shards of concrete to the steps. His eyes were open now, but they were quite empty, rolled back into his skull, until the dirty bluish whites alone showed. But he was still quite limp and helpless. Just before they reached the porch, the front door opened, and his wife came out and closed the door behind her and stood there watching them. They knew that it was his wife because she came out of the house where he was known to live. One of the men, though a resident of the town, had never seen her before.
"What is it?" she said.
"He's all right," the first man said. "We just been having a right smart of excitement downtown a while ago, and with this hot weather and all, it was a little too much for him." She stood before the door as if she were barring them from the house. A dumpy, fat little woman with a round face like dirty and unovened dough and a tight screw of scant hair.
"They just caught that nigger Christmas that killed that lady up at Jefferson last week," the man said. "Uncle Doc just got a little upset over it."
Mrs. Hines was already turning back as though to open the door. As the first man said later to his companion, she halted in the act of turning, as if someone had hit her lightly with a thrown pebble.
"Called who?" she said.
"Christmas," the man said.
"That nigger murderer Christmas?"
She stood at the edge of the porch, looking down at them with her gray, still face.
"As if she already knew what I'd tell her,"
the man said to his companion as they returned to the car. "Like she wanted all the same time for me to tell her it was him and it wasn't him."
"What does he look like?" she said.
"Well, I never noticed much," the man said. "They had to bloody him up some, catching him. Young fella. He don't look no more like a nigger than I do, either." The woman looked at them, down at them. Between the two men, Hines stood on his own legs now, muttering a little now, as if he were waking from sleep.
"What do you want us to do with Uncle Doc?" the man said.
She didn't answer that at all. It was as though she hadn't even recognized her husband, the man told his companion later.
"What are they going to do with him?" she said.
"Him?" the man said.
"Oh, the nigger. Well, that's for Jefferson to say. He belongs to them up there."
She looked down at them, gray, still, remote.
"They gonna wait on Jefferson?"
"They?" the man said.
"Oh," he said. "Well, Jefferson ain't too long about it."
He shifted his grip on the old man's arm.
"Where you want us to put him?"
The woman moved then. She descended the steps and approached.
"We'll tote him into the house for you,"
the man said.
"I can tote him," she said.
She and Hines were about the same height, though she was the heavier. She grasped him beneath the arms.
"Euphius,"
she said, not loud.
Euphius.
She said to the two men, quietly, "Let go, I got him." They released him. He walked a little now. They watched her help him up the steps and into the door. She didn't look back.
"She never even thanked us," second man said.
"Maybe we ought to take him back and put him in jail with the niggers since he seemed to know him so well."
"Euphius," the first man said.
"Euphius. I've been wondering for 15 years what his name might be.
Euphius.
Come on, let's get on back. We might miss some of it."
The first man looked at the house, at the closed door through which the two people had vanished.
"She knowed him, too."
"Knowed who?"
"That nigger, Christmas."
"Come on."
They returned to the car. "What do you think about that darn fella coming right into town here within 20 miles of where he done it, walking up and down the main street till somebody recognized him?
Wish it'd been me to recognize him. I could have used that $1,000. But I never do have any luck."
The car moved on. The first man was still looking back at the blank door through which the two people had disappeared. In the hall of that little house, dark and small and rankly odored as a cave, the old couple stood. The old man's spent condition was still little better than coma, and when his wife led him to a chair and helped him into it, it seemed a matter of expediency and concern. But there was no need to return and lock the front door, which she did. She came and stood over him for a while. At first it seemed as if she were just watching him with concern and solicitude. Then a third person would have seen that she was trembling violently, and that she'd lowered him into the chair either before she dropped him to the floor or in order to hold him prisoner until she could speak. She leaned above him, dumpy, obese, gray in color, with a face like that of a drowned corpse. When she spoke, her voice shook, and she strove with it, shaking, her hands clenched upon the arms of the chair in which he half lay, her voice shaking, restrained.
"Euphius, you listen to me. You got to listen to me. I ain't worried you before. In 30 years, I ain't worried you. But now I am going to know, and you got to tell me. What did you do with Millie's baby?"
This ends Disc 11.
Through the long afternoon, they clotted about the square and before the jail. The clerks, the idle, the countrymen in overalls, the talk. It went here and there about the town, dying and burning again like a wind or a fire, until in the lengthening shadows the country people began to depart in wagons and dusty cars, and the townspeople began to move supperward. Then the talk flared again, momentarily revived, to wives and families about supper tables, in electrically lighted rooms and in remote hill cabins with kerosene lamps. And on the next day, the slow, pleasant country Sunday, while they squatted in their clean shirts and decorated suspenders with peaceful pipes about country churches or about the shady dooryards of houses where the visiting teams and cars were tethered, parked along the fence, and the women folks were in the kitchen getting dinner, they told it again. "He don't look any more like a nigger than I do, but it must have been the nigger blood in him. Looked like he'd set out to get himself caught like a man might set out to get married. He'd got clean away for a whole week. If he hadn't set fire to the house, they might not have found out about the murder for a month. And they wouldn't have suspected him then if it hadn't been for a fellow named Brown that the nigger used to sell whiskey while he was pretending to be a white man and tried to lay the whiskey and the killing both on Brown, and Brown told the truth.
Then yesterday morning he come into Mottstown in broad daylight on a Saturday with the town full of folks. He went into a white barber shop like a white man, and because he looked like a white man, they never suspected him. Even when the bootblacks saw how he had on a pair of second-hand brogans that were too big for him, they never suspected. They shaved him and cut his hair, and he paid him, walked out and went right into a store and bought a new shirt and a tie and a straw hat with some of the very money he stole from the woman he murdered. Then he walked the streets in broad daylight like he owned a town, walking back and forth with people passing him a dozen times and not knowing it, till Halliday saw him and ran up and grabbed him and said, "Ain't your name Christmas?" And the nigger said that it was. He never denied it. He never did anything. He never acted like either a nigger or a white man. That was it. That was what made the folks so mad. For him to be a murderer and all dressed up and walk into town like he dared them to touch him when he ought to have been skulking and hiding in the woods, muddy and dirty and running. It was like he never even knew he was a murderer, let alone a nigger, too. And so Halliday, he was excited, thinking about that $1,000, and he'd already hit the nigger a couple times in the face, and the nigger, acting like a nigger for the first time and taking it, not saying anything, just bleeding, sullen, and quiet, Halliday was hollering and holding him when the old man they call Uncle Doc Hines come up and begun to hit the nigger with his walking stick until at last two men had to hold Uncle Doc quiet and took him home in the car. Nobody knew if he really did know the nigger or not. He'd just come hobbling up, screeching, "Is his name Christmas? Did you say Christmas?" and shoved up and took one look at the nigger and then begun to beat him with the walking stick. He acted like he was hypnotized or something. That hold him, and his eyes rolling blue into his head and slobbering at the mouth and cutting with that stick and everything that come into reach, till all of a sudden he kind of flopped. Then two fellas carried him home in a car, and his wife came out and took him into the house, and the two fellas come on back to town. They didn't know what was wrong with him to get so excited after the nigger was caught, but anyway, they thought that he'd be all right now. But here it was, not a half an hour before he was back downtown again. He was pure crazy by now, standing on the corner and yelling at whoever would pass, calling them cowards, because they wouldn't take the nigger out of jail and hang him right then and there, Jefferson or no Jefferson. He looked crazy in the face, like somebody that had done slipped away from a crazy house, that knew he wouldn't have much time before they'd come and got him again. Folks say he used to be a preacher, too. He said that he had a right to kill the nigger. He never said why, and he was too worked up and crazy to make sense, even when somebody would stop him long enough to ask a question. There was a right good crowd around him by then, and him yelling about how it was his right to say first whether the nigger should live or should die. And folks were beginning to think that maybe the place for him was in the jail with the nigger, when he heard his wife come up. There are folks that have lived in Mottstown for 30 years, have never seen her. They didn't know who she was then, till she spoke to him. 'Cause the ones that had seen her, she was always around that little house in Niggertown where they live, in a Mother Hubbard and one of his wore-out hats. But she is dressed up now. She had on a purple silk dress and a hat with a plume on it, and she was carrying an umbrella, and she come up to the crowd where he was hollering and yelling, and she said, "Euphius." He stopped yelling then, and he looked at her with that stick still raised in his hand and it kind of shaking, and his jaw dropped slack, slobbering. She took him by the arm. A lot of folks had been scared to come nigh him because of that stick. He looked like he might hit anybody at any minute and not even noted or intended it. But she walked right up under the stick and took him by the arm and led him across to where there was a chair in front of a store and set him down in the chair. And she said, "You stay here till I come back. Don't you move now. And you quit that yelling." And he did. He sure did.
He sat right there where she put him, and she never looked back neither. They all noticed that. Maybe it was because folks never saw her except around home, staying at home. And him being a kind of fierce little old man that a man wouldn't cross without he thought about it first. Anyhow, they were surprised. They hadn't even thought of him taking orders from anybody. It was like she'd got something on him and he had to mind her. Because he sat down when she told him to in that chair, not hollering and talking big now, but with his head bent down and his hands shaking on that big walking stick and a little slobber still running out of his mouth onto his shirt. She went straight to the jail. There was a big crowd in front of it because Jefferson had sent word that they were on the way down to get the nigger. She walked right through him and into the jail, and she said to Metcalf, "I want to see that man they caught." "What do you want to see him for?" Metcalf said. "I ain't going to bother him," she said. "I just want to look at him." Metcalf told her there was a right smart other folks that wanted to do that, and that he knew she didn't aim to help him escape, but that he was just the jailer, and he couldn't let anybody in without he had permission from the sheriff. And her, standing there in that purple dress, and the plume not even nodding and bending, she was that still. "Where is the sheriff?" she said.
"He might be in his office," Metcalf said. "You find him and get permission from him, and then you can see the nigger." Metcalf thought that that would finish it, so he watched her turn and go out and walk through the crowd in front of the jail and go back up the street toward the square. Now, the plume was nodding now. He could see it nodding along above the fence, and then he saw her go across the square and into the courthouse. The folks didn't know what she was doing because Metcalf hadn't had time to tell them what had happened at the jail. They just watched her go on into the courthouse, and then Russell said how he was in the office and he happened to look up, and there that hat was with the plume on it just beyond the window across the counter. He didn't know how long she'd been standing there waiting for him to look up. He said she was just tall enough to see over the counter so that she didn't look like she had any body at all. Just looked like somebody had sneaked up and set a toy balloon with a face painted on it and a comic hat set on top of it like the Katzenjammer kids in the funny paper. "I want to see the sheriff," she says. "He ain't here," Russell says. "I'm his deputy. What can I do for you?" He said she didn't answer for a while, standing there. Then she said, "Where can I find him?" "He might be at home," Russell says. "He'd been right busy this week, up at night some, helping those Jefferson officers. He might be home taking a nap, but maybe I can..." But he said that she was already gone. He said he looked out the window and watched her go on across the square and turn the corner toward where the sheriff lived. He said he was still trying to place her to think who she was. She never found the sheriff, but it was too late then anyway, because the sheriff was already at the jail. Only Metcalf hadn't told her, and besides, she hadn't got good away from the jail before the Jefferson officers came up in two cars and went into the jail. They came up quick and went in quick. But the word had already got around that they were there, and there must have been 200 men and boys and women, too, in front of the jail when the two sheriffs come out onto the porch, and our sheriff made a speech asking the folks to respect the law, and that him and the Jefferson sheriff both promised that the nigger would get a quick and fair trial. And then somebody in the crowd says, "Fair hell, did he give that white woman a fair trial?" And they hollered then, crowding up like they were hollering for one another to the dead woman and not to the sheriffs. But the sheriff kept on talking quiet to him about how it was his sworn word given to them on the day they elected him that he was trying to keep. "I have no more sympathy with nigger murderers than any other white man here," he says, "but it is my sworn oath, and by God I aim to keep it. I don't want no trouble, but I ain't going to dodge it." You better smoke that for a while. And Halliday was there, too, with the sheriffs. He was the foremost one about reason and not making trouble. Yeah, somebody hollers, we reckon you don't want him lynched, but he ain't worth any $1,000 to us. He ain't worth 1,000 dead matches to us. And then the sheriff says quick, what if Halliday don't want him killed? Don't we all want the same thing? Here it's a local citizen that'll get the reward. The money'll be spent right here in Mottstown. Just suppose it was the Jefferson man was going to get it. Ain't that right, man? Ain't that sensible? His voice sounded little like a doll's voice, like even a big man's voice will sound when he's talking not against folks listening, but against their already half-made-up minds. Anyway, that seemed to convince him. Even if folks did know that Mottstown or nowhere else was going to see enough of that $1,000 to fat a calf, if Halliday was the one that had the spending of it. But that did it. Folks are funny. They can't stick to one way of thinking or doing anything unless they get a new reason for doing it ever so often. Then, when they do get a new reason, they're liable to change anyhow. So, they didn't give back exactly. It was like when before that crowd had kind of milled from the inside out, now it begun to mill from the outside in. And the sheriffs knew it, the same as they knew that it might not last very long, because they went back into the jail quick and then come out again almost before they had time to turn around with the nigger between them and 5 or 6 deputies following. They must have had him ready just inside the jail door all the time because they come out almost at once with the nigger between them with his face soled up and his wrists handcuffed to the Jefferson sheriff. And the crowd kind of says, ah. They made a kind of lane down to the street where the first Jefferson car was waiting with the engine running and a man behind the wheel, and the sheriffs were coming along without wasting any time, when she come up again, the woman, Miss Hines. She was shown up through the crowd. She was so low built that all the folks could see was that plume kind of bumping along slow, like something that couldn't have moved very fast even if there wasn't anything in the way, and that couldn't anything stop. Like a tractor. She shoved right on through and out into the lane the folks had made, right out in front of the two sheriffs with the nigger between them, so that they had to stop to keep from running over her. Her face looked like a big hunk of putty, and her hat had got knocked sideways so the plume hung down in front of her face, and she had to push it back to see. But she didn't do anything. She just stopped them dead for a minute while she stood there and looked at the nigger. She never said a word. Like that was all she'd wanted and had been worrying folks for. Like that was the reason she'd dressed up and come to town. Just to look that nigger in the face once. Because she turned and begun to burrow back into the crowd again, and when the cars drove off with the nigger and the Jefferson law and the folks looked around, she was gone. And they went back to the square then, and Uncle Doc was gone too from the chair where she'd set him and told him to wait. But all the folks didn't go straight back to the square. A lot of them stayed there looking at the jail like it might have been just the nigger's shadow that had come out. They thought that she'd taken Uncle Doc home. It was in front of Dollar's store, and Dollar told about how he saw her come back up the street ahead of the crowd. He said that Uncle Doc hadn't moved, that he was still sitting in the chair where she'd left him like he was hypnotized, until she come up and touched his shoulder, and he got up, and they went on together, with Dollar watching him. And Dollar said that from the look on Uncle Doc's face, home was where he ought to be. Only she never took him home. After a while, folks saw that she wasn't having to take him anywhere. It was like they both wanted to do the same thing. The same thing, but for different reasons, and each one knew that the other's reason was different, and that whichever of them got his way, it would be serious for the other one. Like they both knew it without saying it,
and that each was watching the other, and that they both knew that she would have the most sense about getting them started. They went straight to the garage where Salmon keeps his rent car. She did all the talking. She said they wanted to go to Jefferson. Maybe they never dreamed that Salmon would charge them more than a quarter apiece, because when he said $3, she asked him again, like maybe she couldn't believe her ears. $3, Salmon says. I couldn't do it for no less. And them standing there, and Uncle Doc not taking any part like he was waiting, like it wasn't any concern of his, like he knew that he wouldn't need to bother, that she would get him there. I can't pay that, she says. You won't get it done no cheaper, Salmon says, less by the railroad. They'll take you for 52 cents apiece. But she is already going away, with Uncle Doc following her like a dog would. That was about 4 o'clock. Until 6 o'clock, the folks saw him sitting on a bench in the courthouse yard. They weren't talking. It was like each one never even knew the other one was there. They just sat there, side by side, with her all dressed up in her Sunday clothes. Maybe she was enjoying herself all dressed up and downtown all Saturday evening. Maybe it was to her what being in Memphis all day would be to other folks. They sat there until the clock struck 6. Then they got up. Folks that saw it said she never said a word to him, that they just got up at the same time like two birds do from a limb, and a man can't tell which one of them give the signal. When they walked, Uncle Doc walked a little behind her. They crossed the square this way and turned into the street toward the depot. And the folks knew that there wasn't any train due for 3 hours, and they wondered if they actually were going somewhere on the train before they found out that they were going to do something that surprised the folks more than that even. They went to that little cafe down by the depot and ate supper. That had never been seen together on the street before, let alone eating in a cafe, since they'd come to Mottstown. But that's where she took him. Maybe they were afraid they'd miss the train if they ate downtown, because they were there before 6:30, sitting on two of them little stools at the counter, eating what she'd ordered without asking Uncle Doc about it at all. She asked the cafe man about the train to Jefferson, and he told her it went at 2 a.m. Lots of excitement in Jefferson tonight, he says. You can get a car downtown and be in Jefferson in 45 minutes. You don't need to wait until 2 o'clock on that train. He thought they were strangers, maybe, and he told her which way town was. But she didn't say anything, and they finished eating, and she paid him a nickel and a dime at a time out of a tied-up rag that she took out of the umbrella, with Uncle Doc sitting there and waiting with that dazed look in his face like he was walking in his sleep. Then they left, and the cafe man thought they were going to take his advice and go to town and get that car when he looked out and saw him going on across the switch tracks toward the depot. Once he started to call, but he didn't. I reckon I misunderstood her, he says he thought. Maybe it's the 9 o'clock southbound they want. They were sitting on the bench in the waiting room when the folks, the drummers and loafers and such, begun to come in and buy tickets for the southbound. The agent said how he noticed there was some folks in the waiting room when he come in after supper at 7:30, but that he never noticed particular until she come to the ticket window and asked what time the train left for Jefferson. He said he was busy at the time and that he just glanced up and says, tomorrow, without stopping what he was doing. Then he said that after a while something made him look up, and there was that round face watching him and that plume still in the window. And she says, I want 2 tickets on it. That train is not due until 2 o'clock in the morning, the agent says. He didn't recognize her either. If you want to get to Jefferson any time soon, you better go to town and hire a car. And you know which way town is? But he said she just stood there,
counting nickels and dimes out of that knotted rag, and he came and gave her the two tickets, and then he looked past her through the window and saw Uncle Doc, and he knew who she was. And he said how they sat there, and the folks for the southbound come in, and the train come and left, and they still sat there. He said how Uncle Doc still looked like he was asleep or doped or something. And then the train went. But some of the folks didn't go back to town. They stayed there, looking in the window. And now and then they would come in and look at Uncle Doc and his wife sitting on the bench till the agent turned off the lights in the waiting room. Some of the folks stayed even after that. They could look in the window and see him sitting there in the dark. Maybe they could see the plume and the white of Uncle Doc's head. And then Uncle Doc begun to wake up. It wasn't like he was surprised to find where he was, nor that he was where he didn't want to be. He just roused up, like he'd been coasting for a long time now, and now was the time to put on the power again. They could hear her saying, "Shh, shh," to him. Then his voice would break out. They were still sitting there when the agent turned on the lights and told them that the 2 o'clock train was coming, with her saying, "Shh, shh," like to a baby, and Uncle Doc hollering, "Bitchery and abomination, abomination and bitchery."